It's bold. It's informative. Welcome to Truth Talk with Myron.
Today, we're going to dive into the international situation. Today, we have with us David M. Hauser from the University of Pittsburgh, and we're honored to have with us also Chelsea Brown. Let's take a moment to meet our guest. Mr. Hauser is the lead instructor from the Department of Introductory of Global Political Issues there at the University of Pittsburgh. And Ms. Chelsea Brown from SMU University is a graduate from the University of North Texas. I'd like to welcome you both to the program this morning.
We're glad to be
here. Myron, happy to be here.
Thank you. Ms. Brown, we'll start with you this morning. For our audience who's unfamiliar with your expertise, give us a little bit more background about your career, please.
Okay, sure. I had a kind of a mixed scenario. I studied finance, but then and worked for the Foreign Agricultural Service, which is part of the USDA in Moscow. So I got to spend about a year in Russia and then finished my PhD and taught for a year in Christchurch, New Zealand, at the University of Canterbury there, and then actually wound up getting a job here at Southern Methodist University back in Texas, and currently I work for the Tower Center for Political Studies, and I'm the Director of Academic Affairs for that program.
Okay. So, all right. And Mr. Hauser?
I did my undergraduate back in the 80s and 90s in political science and physics, which was sort of an oddball. I worked in Washington, D.C. for a while for Congress, and then up in New England for a governor for one legislative session, went back to get my PhD at the University of Pittsburgh, graduated in mid-2000, and then went to West Virginia University, which was expanding its program in national security studies, and signed on there, and now I teach a bunch of courses in national security and international politics.
All right. Well, with that being said, as we go into the topic today, Ms. Brown, we'll start with you.
Mm-hmm.
On a broad scale, I guess you could say, looking at the current situation with in America and foreign policies and international issues, what would you say are America's global challenges right now?
I think especially given all the events of this week, clearly security is going to be on everyone's mind, and I think it is a challenge. Of course, you think of North Korea and you think of Iran with the nuclear weapons issues. Terrorism is certainly on everyone's minds, and the root causes, what we can do about that. I think even though it's kind of not been the most salient in the news right now, we have to look towards Latin America, and we still have issues with drug cartels and violence south of the border. And I also think we have to look at countries like possibly what's going to go on in Venezuela, the future there. But also even looking at economic development and being from an economic perspective, the crisis in Europe is really one that has been very long going and could very much change the political landscape of Europe in the next couple of years. So there's a big roundabout kind of mishmash of everything, but economics and security.
Okay. We'll dive a little bit more in detail in that. Mr. Hauser, your response to it?
I'm a little more sanguine about this. I don't really think that the U.S. faces any large-scale incredible threats like we did sort of during the Cold War. We faced a much more existential threat with tens of thousands of Soviet nuclear warheads pointed at us and trying to manage a difficult situation against a peer competitor, if you want to call them that. Since the end of the Cold War, we've certainly faced a number of security challenges and continue to face them, but none of them, at least to my mind, seem as pressing and as desperate as the issue of, you know, global thermonuclear war, as they used to say. And certainly it's a complicated world, and certainly we're going to have some difficulty navigating the future with the rise of China and all the things that Chelsea was talking about, and I don't disagree with any of those, but I just don't see the United States as threatened as it was in decades past.
Okay. Well, let's get into this. Let's dive a little bit more into detail with that right quick. Let's take a look at, let's say, the global economy. And due to the lack of political will, if you will, in the United States and Europe, there are political tensions in certain economic regions, the Persian Gulf, East Asia, if you will. And those challenges that we face are serious, and it's very critical. The U.S. seems to not be able to get its economic house in order. So with the global economy, let's examine that for a little bit.
Okay.
Mr. Hauser, your response. I mean, how do we deal with this situation?
I don't know. I mean, can you give me some more specifics? I don't really see that. I mean, certainly the U.S. is facing some difficult decisions financially and economically with respect to some of the budgets. Although, again, I don't really fall on the side of saying that we're in a crisis at this point. We've just come out of a pretty awful recession starting in 2008 in the United States. I think the budgetary imbalances of the last few years will almost certainly clean up and look a whole lot better as the economy, if the economy gets rolling again. And so the budgetary problems of the last few years, it seems to me, are going to sort of pale in hindsight in a decade or so when we look back at with a robust economy.
And I would actually agree with Mr. Hauser on this. I think despite, you know, kind of the almost constant negative stream of information that we get, if you look historically and you look at things like our debt balance, if you look at deficits, if you look at things like unemployment, even though people, of course, are very concerned, it's really not that bad. And I agree with Mr. Hauser that, you know, 10, 20 years from now, we're going to look back, and this isn't going to be anything that's, it's not the second Great Depression, I don't think, by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, so you guys think that the current, let's stay with the U.S., you said that it's not that bad. And in a past segment, in a past show we had a couple of weeks back, we talked about the job issue came up. The numbers were staggering. You know, certainly the economists that were on at the time said, you know, it may not be as bad. It wasn't as bad as it was in the past, but they're not great. And as you said, you know, you get a lot of negative information, but we also get misleading information. The numbers are bad. It's still bad. You guys don't agree with that? Y'all don't think it's still a bad situation, especially when it comes to unemployment? People are still looking for work, you know, and a lot of people have dropped out of the search for jobs, right? So that plays a role in the numbers that you receive, you know, but
absolutely.
That's kind of...
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, no, and I don't mean to imply that the situation is ideal by any stretch of the imagination. And you certainly see a huge amount of regional disparity and unemployment, and that's actually something that's maybe a little bit more of a pressing issue than numbers overall. Down here in Texas, actually, unemployment isn't horrible. Like I said, I didn't mean to imply that we're, you know, sitting in a field of clover here, but if you compare the U.S., you know, national rates to what they're experiencing, you look at the unemployment rates in Greece and Spain and Portugal. Spain hit close especially for people under the age of, if you're under the age of 34, unemployment is something like 29%. And there's, you know, areas that have pockets that aren't in the big cities that actually have close to 50%. While we certainly have some very economically hard-hit areas, we're not in a position where one out of three of us are unemployed. So that's kind of my frame of reference. Mr. Hauser may have a different opinion on this.
You have an opinion on it, Mr. Hauser? Hello?
Hello?
Okay. Well, moving on. You guys brought up Israel, the United States, and Iran. Okay, let's dive into that a little more. With the Israel, with the conflict that's going on over there, I mean, what do you agree with the policy that the U.S. has right now as far as Israel, the United States, and Iran is concerned?
Do you, who?
You can go ahead and take this.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I wasn't sure if you were going to go with that. And I'm not a super security expert. Honestly, I'm not sure the U.S. has a consistent policy at this point. We strongly support Israel, and everyone prefers that Iran not have nuclear weapons. The strategy is for deterring Iran. I think there might be a little bit of a difference of policy. There's certainly been a lot of tension between Netanyahu and President Obama. I think in some ways that might have hindered any progress. Although, to be honest, I'm not sure you're ever going to get a peace deal between Palestine and Israel. Many, many people have tried. But I think our policy over nuclear weapons, we're on the same side. Nobody wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. But whether this should be through diplomacy or through threats of, you know, possible, whether we do it through sanctions, whether we try talks, whether we use carrots, we use sticks, whether or not we should consider military options, I think there may be a difference of opinion there between the U.S. and Israel.
Okay. Do you think the Palestinians will play a role in that?
Absolutely. Well, in the Iran question,
yes.
No. I was going to say no. At this point, I mean, the Palestinians, either faction, they have no, they're not going to support a nuclear weapon in Iran either. And there might be a few that are kind of like, yes, okay, enemy of my enemy. But they stand to most countries in the Middle East, whether they are publicly supportive or not, do not like the idea of Iran having nuclear weapons. They do not like the idea of Iran being the regional hegemon. And so, again, sometimes there is quiet support, sometimes there is public derision, but I would, from what I've seen, heard, I have a colleague that was the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, no one wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. And how you go about deterring them is there, but is Palestine going to be a huge player either way? No, they simply don't have either. They don't have the diplomatic capacity. They don't have any kind of military capacity to do much with it. So I think they're not going to be an issue on the Iran situation.
Okay. Mr. Hauser, I don't know if you heard the question or not, but as I was talking to Ms. Brown, Dr. Brown, the question was asked about Israel, the United States, and Iran, and if the current policy that is in place is acceptable, if you will, if that's the right word to use, or do you agree with the policy?
I think the policy, well, okay, so two separate questions, whether it's
right.
Working well and whether I the end points. I think the standard policy of the United States is, and President Obama has been pretty clear about this, is that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. I think the present policy is working reasonably well at accomplishing that. Part of what you have to look at is what are the alternatives. So we've got a huge sanctions regime in place that is attempting to convince a whole bunch of other states to go along with cutting off trade and relations with Iran. That seems to be working. At a bare minimum, it is slowing down the ability of Iran to technologically develop the capacity to build nuclear weapons. The alternative, I don't know what would be. Iran has seemed pretty clear that they want nuclear weapons, or at least they want the capacity for them. And so if we truly want to ensure that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, we have to talk about the use of military force. And the use of military force gets really, really complicated with respect to Iran. Iran has done a lot to disperse their nuclear facilities all over their country. They've done a lot to harden them with respect to making them more resistant to bombing. Iran is a much larger country and much more difficult to invade. And coming out of a couple of invasions in the Middle East, I don't think anyone in America really is interested in invading yet another country in the Middle East. So the present policy is working okay, not perfectly. The alternatives seem worse. whether we want Iran to have a nuclear weapon, no, I don't think we do. But as Dr. Brown noted, not very many states in the Middle East want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. So we're doing okay in trying to convince everybody else that they don't want them either, and our diplomacy seems to be the best of a bunch of middling to bad options.
Okay. You brought up the sanctions, the subject of sanctions. But really, the sanctions are not really working. As you say, they're working at a bare minimum. I agree with that. But in some essence, they're not doing anything. It's just lip service, if you will, to some degree. To jump from that issue kind of to another issue with the same context, North Korea. You look at what's happening with North Korea, right? What does that say to Iran? I mean, that they don't care, basically. They're going to do what they want to do, and that's all there is to it. Isn't that, if they're allowed, the United States has not really done very little, I guess you could say, in some context with that. And how does that play into Iran? If Iran sees how the United States is dealing with North Korea, how does that imply to them?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the ways that at least I know of some of the folks in international relations talk about this is if you go back over the past 10 or 15 years, the trend line seems to be that if you are a small state and you possess nuclear weapons, the United States won't mess with you very much. If you do have, or if you look like you're getting nuclear weapons but don't yet have them, the United States actually is willing to use lots of things, including military force, to come after you. So Libya sort of was drifting down the path towards that, but then saw what we did in Iraq. We invaded them, at least in part, because of their nuclear weapons program. We didn't invade North Korea because they clearly have nuclear weapons, and Iran kind of looked at those two and said, well, having them seems to be a lot smarter than not having them. And North Korea looks around and realizes that if they agree to give them up, then they are also potentially invadable, although I don't think we ever would because of China and other things. But nonetheless, I think that in Iran's defense, if you want to look at it that way, it makes a lot of sense for them to look around the world and say, you know, nuclear weapons don't seem like a really bad idea. With respect to North Korean sanctions, I'm not sure what else we can do. We have them in place. There's lots of other countries that refuse to trade with North Korea because of their nuclear weapons program. They are clearly crippling the North Korean economy. They're clearly making it much harder for North Korea to get the technology and the financing to continue their nuclear weapons program. Absent those sanctions, North Korea might be significantly further along than they are now. And I think the same can be said about Iran. So while the sanctions don't seem to be sexy and doing a lot of good, I think they have actually done a lot to slow down both nuclear programs. We don't like them. They don't seem to be effective at stopping the nuclear programs, but I think they're pretty effective at slowing them down.
Can I actually want to jump in? Because I agree that sanctions have slowed things down. But I would also, maybe Myron, to go to your point about if you're Iran, do you look around and see North Korea as an example? And I think, I agree with everything Professor Hauser says. I actually think there is one difference, and that North Korea is such a pariah in the international community. And Iran wants to be seen as a legitimate player. They actually want, I mean, yes, they have absolutely every, and if you were Iran too, you would go for nuclear weapons. I think that's I always have my students do a simulation, and I change the names of the countries around into fictitious ones, and then they figure out that it was like, oh, okay. And every single one of them, or 90% of them, will be like, oh, you absolutely pursue a nuclear strategy. It's in Iran's interest to do so. But I'm not sure they're looking at the North Korean example. Iran is much more tied to the global economy. Sanctions are going to hurt them more. And they also want to be seen as a legitimate government, as a legitimate negotiator, as a legitimate member of the international community. North Korea doesn't seem to, at least under the two previous regimes, seem to have that want or that need. They're pretty isolated. But that's my take on things. So,
okay.
No, I think those are both very good points. Iran has a very different foreign policy and is situated in a very different part of the world, and really does think of itself as someday wanting to be kind of the regional hegemon in the Middle East. North Korea is trying to survive day to day, and so they have much less grandiose concerns. So Iran's issue with nuclear weapons is it gives them prestige, but they also need to gain those nuclear weapons without completely annoying everyone else in the world, and that makes them walk a very tightrope.
Yes. Okay. I also think it makes the, I think that's probably why they haven't, I think they could have, if they had been completely just been, no, we're doing this, and didn't care about, to some extent, their reputation, I think they already would have had them. But, there was some sort of semblance for attempts to, again, it was that international legitimacy question. Do you kind of sort of cooperate? How much do you cooperate? How much is this a regional power play within the Middle East? It's, as you said, it's a very, very, very different approach, I think, to foreign policy by Iran. North Korea is geographically and economically pretty, well, maybe not geographically, but at least they're not in the middle of a battle for regional hegemony.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Are you getting emailed by yourself? Do you find that programs are popping up of their own accord? Sometimes not allowing you to do the basic functions you normally do on a program you know so well? Yes, it's time for you to take your computer into Computer Repairs and Solutions. And they're located at 155 Southwest Plaza, Arlington, Texas. Or simply call 817-483-0933 today. Let me repeat, that's 817-483-0933 today.
Are you tired of hearing biased news reports or unfair journalists reporting their own agendas? Tune in.
Do you find others unsympathetic to your understanding?
Yes.
Don't know how to tell it like it is?
Right.
It's time to tune in to
Truth Talk with Myron on BBS Radio every other Saturday at 10 a.m. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.
Still trying to figure out who to listen to? You should tune in to Myron of Truth Talk.
Welcome back to Truth Talk with Professor David Hauser and Professor Chelsea Brown. Let's talk about the defense strategy. Do you guys agree with today's defense strategy and that it has two principle-related vectors, if you will?
What are those two vectors? What do you see as those two vectors?
Well, I think global commons is one. I would say the Pacific is another. I think we already discussed what follows that, which would be the Middle East. We kind of discussed that a little bit. I mean, do you guys agree with that, or you see something different?
Chelsea, you
want to
run with that?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll take the first part. The idea, you had mentioned that one of these vectors was this global commons, CU space and computer cyber lanes for trade and commerce. Yes, the U.S. is very interested in our economic interest. And there's certainly economics certainly has a role in security, but I'm not sure that we are. I'm not entirely sure that that is the number one priority of our defense strategy. I do think that, I mean, there has been much discussion about the pivot towards the Pacific and concerns about China, concerns about North Korea, other parts of maybe if you want to include Asia in a broader context, certainly Pakistan, I think, has to come up on the list. But I am not entirely certain, and you both may disagree, I'm not sure that the trade in Kotlik, access for commerce, is the number one strategy. And like I said, Professor Hauser is probably much more, is going to give you a much better detail on this. I know he teaches national security, so he can probably, I can tell you all a bunch about the economic side of things, but specifically how it relates to defense strategy, I think I might have to defer to his opinion.
Okay. We'll get to the economics of it here in a second. But your response, Dr. Hauser?
Well, I think that, first off, there's no real threat to the global commons at this point. So, yeah, I think the global commons is important to the United States defense strategies, but I also don't think that there's a threat to it, so it kind of gets pushed down the list just because there's nothing for us to do about it. Most of the major states in the world that have significant militaries are on our side, if you want to look at it that way. And we can talk about China if you want, but they certainly benefit from the trade both on the internet and in physical reality as well. And so they're happy with the state of the global commons, as is everybody. So there's no real major state out there that's attempting to interdict or interfere with the global commons. Is the U.S. pivoting towards Asia? Sure, we're pivoting towards Asia because we're not entirely clear what China's up to, and because the bulk of the states around the Asian perimeter are huge trading partners of ours. I mean, Europe's also a huge trading partner, but the growth is clearly in Asia, and the U.S., if it's going to be a part of how those trading routes develop and how the diplomatic relations of the states in Asia come together over the next 20 to 50 years, the U.S. needs to have a presence there, and that not only means a military presence, it means an economic presence and a diplomatic presence as well. So the pivot to Asia, I think, is tied to concerns with global commons. But, yeah, the U.S. is the major power on the planet. We benefit extraordinarily much from the global commons as it exists because, in part, we set it up, and we're invested in keeping the global commons going, but there's no threat to it, so no one really worries about it, at least in the present tense.
Okay. Do you think that the current, say, the current plans or the support to support them, first of all, and to you, Dr. Brown, do you think that they're affordable with the, you know, say, the budget that's in place for them and the, you know, it's two questions here, I understand, but one is it acceptable? Secondly, is it affordable?
Well, I think, if we look purely at a Department of Defense budget, are they acceptable or are they affordable? The acceptability thing, I think, actually really boils down to maybe a little bit or a more philosophical kind of identity situation, which is what is the role of defense strategy? Is it purely a military security, or is it, should it be involved with things like economic development? Should we be concerned about the role in, you know, in not necessarily nation building, but, it's a question, I think, that comes down to what is the appropriate role of defense strategy. The affordability, do you want a Corolla or do you want a Cadillac? Are they affordable? Anything's affordable. It's just a question of what do you really want. There's a lot of waste in the budget, but when you're deciding on budgets, there's so much of the political element that comes in at the domestic level. So it's who gets, you know, here in Fort Worth, we want contracts for Lockheed Martin. And we want to push through bills and budgetary appropriations that fund everybody's respective area, basically your standard pork barrel thing. A lot of that goes into the affordability question. If you look at it more broadly, sure. You know what? Yes, we can afford to do what we want. It's a question of priorities. It's a question of where we want to put things. And it's a question of how much do you want to do? You can buy the affordable, like, sedan, or you can buy the tricked-out giant SUV. Both will get you where you want to go. It just kind of depends on the style that you want to get there in. So to use a maybe not the best analogy ever, I would say, sure, it's affordable. But you have to decide on what exactly you want to do with it.
Okay. Dr. Howes, do you agree with that?
Yeah, roughly. I think that the Defense Department budget, which is hovering in the sort of $600 to $700 billion a year range at this point, if you include the intelligence budget at least, is going to come down, but it's going to come down at least in part because we've pretty much ended the war in Iraq and we're ending the war in Afghanistan. And to a large degree, we've been fairly successful in the war on terror, and so we just don't need spending in those areas that we have in the past decade or so. And it makes sense for it to come down. There are larger sociological pressures on the budget, but that goes back to issues of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other things over time. But if you look at the long-term trend, defense budgets are usually hovering between 3 and 4% of GDP. That's where it is these days. I think it's a little above 4 right now, but the trends are it's going to come by somewhere between 3 and 4, and that's normal.
Okay. Now.
Agreed. Yeah, I was going to say spending fluctuates. I mean, we had huge during the Cold War, 1980s, huge military buildup. Defense spending went way down in the 90s, where to some extent, you know, considerably down, at least in equipment. But it was, we just had enough. We didn't have to buy it. You know, we didn't have to buy anything for a couple of years. The immediate threat of the Soviet Union, you know, for the moment was gone. And yeah, they fluctuate. But Professor Hauser's right, and it's we look at these budgetary numbers and they look astronomical. I mean, you know, $600-700 billion a year is, you know, I'd take 1% and it would be fine. But over, right. You know, it's if you look at it as a percentage of, the relative size of the U.S. economy now, $14 trillion, it's just not that much in comparison. So.
Okay. Now, let's change gears here a little bit. I know we've touched kind of broadly on the subject, but what challenges do we face in China? First, we'll start with China, then we'll deal with North Korea. What challenges do we face in China?
Professor Hauser, you go first on this one.
Okay. I think the first thing to remember about China is a whole bunch of different things. So China is not one monolithic state making one monolithic policy to either oppose or go along with the United States. There are factions in China that don't particularly like the United States. There are factions in China that love the United States, and there are factions in China that are neutral. There are factions in China that get all fired up about nationalism when they bump into us, and there are factions that don't care so much. So China has not yet proven to be either a competitor to the U.S. like the USSR was back in the Cold War, nor has it proven to be a constant friend to the United States like Britain or most of Europe is clearly today. It's somewhere in the middle. So it makes sense for us to pay more attention to them. It makes sense for us to pivot some of our resources towards the Pacific, and that not only, again, includes military, but includes economic and political and social and cultural, because we want to encourage China to continue to be friendly with us.
We would like China to be an ally so that we can both grow rich over time and everyone benefits from that. If, on the other hand, and there's lots of IR theory that argues that we're going to bump into each other in a conflictual way, if there's going to be conflict, well, we need to be prepared for that. And that's why we have to sort of think about it now and start to think about what we want to do about it in the future. But I don't think anything is carved in stone at this point. It's all going to be sort of how things play out in the next couple of decades.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think there's China very much is, we tend to, I think especially news media and when we consume things, we like to put regions into categories. We like to talk about Asia. We like to talk about the Middle East. We like to talk about Africa. But, as Dr. Hauser pointed out, there is an incredible amount of diversity and of opinion and of strategies within those regions and within some countries. So China is, we are important to China. China is important to us.
Right.
And it's not a, the Soviet Union was pretty much this wonderful bipolar of us against them. It was, you know, kind of very, you know, two superpowers battling it out in this kind of like, you know, very typical bipolar sort of situation. But China is concerned about its economic interest, but it's concerned about its political interest. I look to some of China's activities. I also think they're looking for some of the prestige. They've been pushing for greater representation in the IMF, in the World Bank. They want to be seen as a little bit more of an economic leader. They are a huge economy, but they're not an automatic friend, as was noted. So, but they're not an automatic enemy either. China is, I think we have to look at China not in the historical sense or a comparative sense. We can't look at it as the same thing as the Soviet Union. We can't look at it like we look at Europe. China is China. And we need to maybe reframe how we think about it and just kind of go, okay, let's think about it as a unique partner, but not necessarily best friend.
Well, do you guys think that's the problem, that the West, say here in the U.S., they kind of look at China as a country without a real true ideology, so to speak? If you understand what I'm saying, you know, like they look at them like you just said. China is China. That's kind of how the West, that's how the United States looks at them, right? It's like they don't know how to really take them.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we think of them as a country without an ideology. I don't think we know what to think yet.
And to the degree that we're still embedded in some sort of Cold War mentality, a lot of folks see China as communist China.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty far from that. Yes, they're authoritarian. Yes, they have all kinds of human rights problems. But their economy is largely capitalist, although there's a huge amount of state presence. To the degree Americans see them as through some sort of ideological prism, it tends to be that sort of communist kind of thing. But that's pretty wrong. And the more we see them as just China, this unique, strange state over there, the better off we're going to be.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right. I do think there's very much a Cold War mentality on China because and I bring up my mother only because I think she's kind of my example of, she's fine, but she was like, everything over there is cold and gray and rainy. It's very much a, you know, she has this image of China as, you know, people that are peasants lining up in bread lines, you know, waiting for a rice line or what, you know. It's very much a Cold War mentality, and it's not. As I was mentioned, it's not. It is a much more market-oriented, much more developed, I think, in many ways, and a much more diverse. It's a huge geographic country, and we just don't see it that way, but we need to.
Right. Do you guys think China has a huge influence on the international community as far as, say, trade goes, and the way that they deal with things? They are very, I guess you could say, they're very influential globally, as far as their involvement in global trade, and they're very innovative in the way that they do things. I mean, some have said, I think, if I'm wrong, correct me, that China could rewrite things if they so chose to within the international community. Do you think that's true? I mean,
trade-wise, they're actually pretty run-of-the-mill. When they became a member of the WTO, yes, there are issues within certain countries. There's intellectual property concerns in China and this and that, but they've forged a pretty traditional path in a lot of ways in terms of economic trade. I don't see that they have done anything that's particularly divergent. They could, you know, when you talk about rewriting the rules.
Well, I guess I was kind of vague.
I'm not sure they necessarily want to rewrite the rules.
Well, what I mean is,
I think they like the rules.
When I say rewrite, I mean, I guess I'm trying to say, like, within the global trading system is what I'm saying. Because as Dr. Hauser said, the capitalistic, right? Well, being capitalistic, doesn't that kind of stall democratic progress within, quote-unquote, global trading?
Yeah, but that's different. I mean, in this case, China is pursuing a lot of, I mean, the trade agreements, the participation, the benefits from capitalism, yes, that you can argue about accountability within global trade. You can argue, we can talk, and that's almost an entirely different show, but the issues of democracy, transparency, and accountability within the international system. But, is China doing anything differently in their trade patterns than anyone else that is less democratic? No. Their national trade system isn't fair or nice. But they're not doing anything that other countries don't.
Okay.
For the most part.
Okay. Dr. Hauser, you want to add anything to that? Or?
No. I mean, he said what needs to be said.
Okay. That's good. You know what? You need to get more adversarial guests.
Right.
To go, no, you're absolutely wrong. That's like the worst thing I've ever heard.
Avoiding confrontation.
We can start disagreeing just for the sake of disagreeing if you want. But
I always take the opposite opinion. But
okay. Let's move on into North Korea then. Real quickly before I do that, Dr. Hauser, do you think the United States policy will change in any way towards China? Since they see China as, will it change? As a prediction, I guess you could say. Will it or will it not?
I think it will change. I think it will change slowly. But I think any good policy should change over time because the world changes over time. United States policy with respect to Afghanistan is changing over time. United States policy with respect to Pakistan is changing over time. United States policy with respect to China is changing over time. It makes sense for everyone's policies to shift as the global economic system causes some states to win and some states to lose, as states spend more or less on military equipment, as states become more or less prominent. Things change. So, yes, United States policy with respect to China will change.
Okay. All right. Now let's move into North Korea. What issues do we face? I think we already know one issue we face with North Korea, but let's dive into that a little bit more.
The North Korean problem is relatively straightforward. They have nuclear weapons capabilities. They are continuing to build better and better nuclear weapons, meaning smaller ones that are more efficient and perhaps larger. In addition, they are continuing to develop missile and rocket technologies that allow them to shoot them farther and farther. It is not, as of right now, at least to my knowledge, North Korea has no ability to put nuclear weapons on a delivery device. In other words, they can't put nuclear weapons on a missile. The farthest range rocket they have, which again, let me reiterate, does not have nuclear capability. The farthest range rocket they have could maybe reach the west coast of the United States, but that's pretty iffy. They've shot off two or three of those, and I think only one of them has worked and the other two didn't. So that's pretty iffy. We know they can probably reach Japan, South Korea, Guam, some parts parts of the United States protectorates in the Pacific. But again, they've shown no indication that they have an actual nuclear capability to put on these things. One of the reasons we have not confronted the use of military power as a way to quote-unquote solve the North Korean problem is, as best I understand, looking at it from afar, the capital of South Korea is Seoul. It's a city of something on the order of 10 million people. It is within 30 miles of the demilitarized zone with North Korea, and North Korea has artillery pieces pointed at Seoul. So if the United States were to use military power on North Korea in an attempt to disrupt their nuclear program, essentially, the city of Seoul is a hostage to the use of military power, and you're to looking at tens of thousands of civilian casualties if the North Koreans wanted to respond to our military power by shooting at South Korea. So in some ways, the use of military force to do something about the North Korean nuclear program is kind of off the table because of the geography of the situation. And so we're reduced to diplomatic options, and diplomatic options are very, very limited because North Korea essentially trades with no one on earth except for China, and China's interests in North Korea are very, very different from our interests in North Korea. And I think China is pretty happy with the situation in North Korea as it stands, and that's why nothing has changed.
Okay.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. I think, like you said, North Korea is kind of a pariah. I really like, and Professor Hauser, I'm afraid I'm going to have to steal your terminology in my class to describe South Korea as hostage. but essentially, I think that's absolutely right. They are hostage. But they also, South Korea is almost kind of North Korea's only, you know, they can throw a temper tantrum. But what are they really going to do? The only thing that they have is leverage is almost the fact that they do have the proximity to South Korea. And yep. I kind of wonder, I was like, aside from South Korea, would we even give them the time of day for the most part? Of course, nuclear weapons are, you know, certainly something to discuss, but without much of a delivery device,
yeah, but the problem is that the technological trajectory over time indicates that North Korea, at some point in the future, whether that's a year from now, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, will have deliverable nuclear capability. At least if the regime stays around and if the regime keeps pouring resources into the nuclear program. So it is a clear problem. Oh, and I should point out, North Korea has clearly shown a willingness in the past to sell nuclear technology. One of the reasons the Pakistani nuclear program got ahead was that the North Koreans helped the Pakistani program jump ahead. So you're right, North Korea is a pariah state. They can kind of hold South Korea hostage, and they're not much of a threat to anybody these days, but they could clearly be a threat at some point in the future, and that's one of the reasons why we're trying to tackle it today. We just have a whole host of bad options.
And that's actually, I think, that was a point that I wanted to make earlier, but I'm curious very much to your opinion on this, which is the bigger threat is, will they sell the technology?
And I think they've shown a willingness to do so in the past, so I don't see why they wouldn't in the future.
Where do you see the biggest, what do you see as the biggest complication from that?
Well, I mean, so the complication is that if they show a willingness to do so, we would be more willing to consider other sort of violent or kinetic approaches to solving, to reducing their ability to do so. I think the reason they haven't done so is there are very few states in the world that want to jump over the nuclear sort of line in the sand. And if they do want to jump over that line, they're even less willing to talk to North Korea about it because, again, North Korea is a pariah. So the fact that they're willing to, I guess the reason they haven't done so since they talked to Pakistan, I don't know, a decade ago or maybe a decade and a half ago, is just that there's really nobody else that's willing to buy from them at this point because there's really not very many states who are even contemplating becoming nuclear powers these days.
What about Iran? You don't think Iran would buy from them?
I don't think Iran.
I think Iran's program is
Russia.
Potentially more advanced. Yeah. They get what they need, at least in terms of civilian nuclear stuff from Russia. I think Iran mm-hmm. has a larger population and is more connected to the West, has better training, better access to things. I think Iran is likely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're probably better at it than the North Koreans are at this point. And again, you've got to think of that pariah thing, right? So Iran's public face is, we are not developing nuclear weapons. Yeah, we're hiding some things, but that's part of our national sovereignty. We have, and the treaties clearly say that Iran has the right to civilian uses of nuclear power, and so they're developing nuclear power domestically so that they can produce energy, which they actually need in their cities for a variety of strange geographic and geopolitical reasons. If Iran were to publicly announce they were going to North Korea to get help with their nuclear technologies, that would make it harder for Iran to tell the rest of the world, hey, we're just the good guys here. We're not really doing anything bad. So, again, North Korea's pariah state status makes it really hard for anyone to reach out to them.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean no one will in the future, but it does mean that nobody's doing it today.
They would do it quietly, but Iran's got that whole, we heard the Persian Empire thing. They're not going to, I think in their minds, ever lower themselves to deal with the North Koreans.
At least
they would argue they don't have to.
Right. Okay. Real quick, we're almost out of time today, but real quick, I mean, as far as North Korea goes, how will policy change, or the U.S. policy change towards them, or will it?
I don't think it will.
I don't think it will, although if I remember sort of correctly in my history, every single president has at one point or another kind of cut a deal with North Korea. So the deal you sort of, Clinton did this, and George W. Bush did this, where you sort of cut a deal with North Korea to sort of sell them some food, sell them some fuel, you know, reduce the sanctions, a slight amount, in return for North Korea opening up to inspectors and coming back under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and things like that. And then North Korea breaks the deal. But every single president has looked at the North Korean problem and realize that maybe the carrot will get you further than the stick will, and everyone's been messed over by this. But nonetheless, everyone kind of tries it because there are so few alternative policy solutions. Will U.S. policy toward North Korea change? Yes, it will change at some point, but actually I kind of think it's less likely to change in North Korea than it is in, say, China or Iran or some other part of the world. We have so few policy alternatives with respect to North Korea. We're already not trading with them. We're already not talking to them. We're already pressuring everyone else around the world to not trade and not talk with them. There's very little we can do to change because we're already doing so little.
Okay.
I agree. There's not much we can do short of the military option. And quite frankly, the carrot is cheaper than the stick.
Okay.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here, sit down, be quiet. Here's your $200 million.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but real quickly, I want both of you to give me your predictions on foreign policy with the United States abroad overall. What are your predictions as far as global economy? Dr. Brown, you first.
30-second soundbite. Europe is a problem. Japan is recovering pretty well. Their debt levels are there. Asia will be okay. It's just that Europe buys much of China's products. We might hit a slump. We saw stratospheric growth that really was a little bit abnormal, and we're used to that. We're going to see growth. It will, you know, you will see emerging economies grow faster than others, but it's quiet, slow progress. I am not pessimistic about. It'll be less than people expect, but it's not going to be bad.
Okay.
How's that?
That was good, Dr. Hauser. Wrap it up for us.
European Union's having a huge problem these days trying to sort things out. They keep putting these Band-Aids on the wound that kicks them down the road 6 months or a year, but they haven't actually done what they need to do to either solve the underlying political problems or just break the union apart and go back into sovereignty, which is going to be a mess in and of itself. The United States economy will recover again slowly over time. The rest of the world economy will recover again slowly over time. 2008, 2009 was a huge recession. And things are going to slowly recover from that, and things will go back to being relatively normal within 5 years or so.
All right. Very good. I want to thank you both for joining us today. Again, I want to thank Dr. Hauser from the University of Pittsburgh and Dr. Chelsea Brown from SMU. Thank you both for taking the time to join us today. Until next time, be prayerful, be wise, and be adaptable.
it like it is. No subject is taboo. If it's brought to the table, you bet we cover it. No more lies, no more deception. You have a right to know. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.